This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 2016, the British newspaper The Guardian asked Ben Fountain to write a monthly column about the U.S. election. He wasn't a political reporter. He wasn't any kind of reporter, but I don't think that's what they wanted from him. I suppose they were hoping for dispatches about American culture, impressions of what exactly was going on here as a brash reality TV star was making a run at the presidency. His essays became the framework for a book called Beautiful Country, Burn Again. And in one of his stories, he writes about a Trump rally in Clinton, Iowa, in the gymnasium of a middle school. Reading his description of the vast roar when Trump presents himself to the crowd, you can see what The Guardian was looking for. Fountain wrote, it was like when the fat Elvis made an entrance in one of his late-life arena shows. Fountain's own politics and his regard for the showman there on the stage were clear, but he wasn't making fun. He's talked about being impressed with Trump's raw charisma, his ability to connect with people, and how the people there in Iowa left the gym feeling legitimately happy. He left feeling sad. But the moment helps explain just what Fountain's writing has been about, justice and power, and as he explains it, why the world is the way it is. Recently, we spoke with Ben Fountain on stage at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts. I want to ask about writing, and I think some here may know the story of, it's kind of an extraordinary story about how you came to be a writer. You didn't start that way. You started as a lawyer and then did your best for 5 years practicing real estate law in Dallas, Texas. But what was it about writing that made you decide to leave a pretty successful law career?
Well, around the age of 16 or 17, it seemed to come to me that I might want to do that kind of work. Try to write fiction, serious fiction, good fiction. And then I got enamored with movies. So I wanted to be a movie director. I went to college, studied literature. I took a lot of French as well. But I decided I would go to law school. I wanted something that would take me into the world, be an education in the world. And I think also, I was profoundly scared of writing. It seemed to me that the chances of failure were great. And it didn't matter how smart you were, how hardworking you were, if you didn't have a certain amount of talent, you may well, be a failure. And I was not ready to face that as a 22-year-old. So I went to law school, and I think I was also hoping that I would forget about this writing thing, and I would go on and have this safe, respectable, lucrative career, and my parents would be proud, and later on my in-laws would be proud. But as the years went by, I realized that I was never going to have any peace in myself if I didn't make a serious effort to do this kind of work. And no, I wasn't. I wasn't writing at all in those years. So it is completely irresponsible, completely irrational, what I did at the age of 30, to quit partnership track, quit the practice of law, and basically go back to first grade, to sit down at my kitchen table one morning instead of going to the law office and say, okay, what's going to happen. But my wife and I talked about it for many years. In fact, 15 minutes into our first date, I told her I had no intention of practicing law my whole life. So she was warned.
You were in law school at the time, though, right?
Yeah. But anyway, it was like stepping off a cliff and hoping the parachute opens.
I think a lot of us learned this story through Malcolm Gladwell. He's written about you and your experience of coming to writing and persevering at writing and coming to such success, but later in the scheme of things. But I wanted to ask you about something that he talks about, and you've talked about too, was that you had to, you knew good writing. You knew you had something in you, but you talked about having to relearn the basics again, as you say, go back to school creating mental images of things. What was that about? What did that mean?
Well, I think most of us, all of us, most of us, in our own way, we know a good piece of writing when we see it.
Yeah.
And I'd read widely and hopefully deeply over the years, so I knew what I wanted to get on the page, but I couldn't get it on the page. And you know, just very basic things like describing a house. Well, what is that? And what is that? And what is this? I didn't know the names of anything. And so I ended up going out getting all these, you know, the Oxford Duden Pictorial Dictionary and all these architecture guides. And then, yeah, I was always saving clothing catalogs because, you know, they tell you what things are called. Eventually I accumulated a guide to perfumes. Just everything, the U.S. Army Survival Guide. It's like writers are desperate people. And we are, you know, it's just like anything that's going to help us, you know, get the words on the page a little bit more accurately and genuinely, we will go to extreme lengths. There was this very laborious process of really starting from scratch and trying to learn how to do this kind of art.
At what point in the process did you start to detect a theme for what you wanted to write? I mean, one of the things you've talked about is that as you were developing as a writer, you found yourself drawn to stories, this is how you put it, where the context was power, politics, race, economics, money, and how these systems affect people. When did that emerge, or was that always sort of there, do you think?
Let's see, the first story I wrote was about an old man with his life savings getting scammed by a stockbroker. Wow. And so money was there from the beginning. Hmm. My dad told me once, he said, economics is the ultimate reality. And if you think about it, I mean, economics is survival. It's food, clothing, shelter.
Yeah.
So I think in one sense, that's correct. And, you know, how do you get money? You know, what do you do with it? What do you do to get it? And then what does it do to you? And so, you know, money and power, I mean, they're all bound up together. But I think as writers, we need to follow our heads and our hearts where they lead us. That is where I discovered my head and my heart were leading me over the years.
Is justice the umbrella, do you think, that all of this falls under?
I think it really is. I think over the years, I've decided, yes. I mean, you could talk about it in terms of just fundamental balance, you know, in human relations. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you, or love your neighbor as yourself. Right? Those are... Let's call it one concept. It's a profound concept. What it requires us to do is recognize the humanity of another person is just as important to them as our humanity is to us. It requires us to step outside of our own reality and to engage in a genuine way with this other reality. And I think on a societal level, when people are doing that and the system is doing that, you get justice. But when people and systems are not attuned to the reality of other people, then you get all kinds of abuses and manipulations and inhumane behaviors.
The idea of the title "Beautiful Country, Burn Again." First you thought it was Joan Didion. I mean, she used it, but it's actually from a poem, a Robinson Jeffers poem.
Well, I found it through Joan Didion.
Yeah.
And it shows up in her book, South by Southwest, the published journals that she kept of travels through the southern part of the United States and the Southwest. But there's a line in there, beautiful country burn again. And I think she's talking about California wildfires. And I thought, oh, here's the title of my book, Beautiful Country Burn Again, because it is a beautiful country. And it has burned. And so then I'm thinking, okay, you know, I got this from Joan Didion. And then my agent says, oh, I love that you want to use this Robinson Jeffers, you know, the line from a Robinson Jeffers poem, you know, for the title of your book. And I'm like, oh, yes, of course. You know, and then I had to go find the Robinson Jeffers poem. But it worked even better this way. I mean, just the context of those lines.
I'm thinking a lot about 2016, Iowa, 2020, Iowa. I'm thinking a lot about Iowa. And the difference in the returns then and now. And wondering in those 4 years, if the thesis, which we'll talk about, we're going to get into the particulars of it, but how much has changed? Are the basic ideas still in place, do you think? Or are things shifting in ways that make that 2016 seem quaint or different in a lot of ways?
Things are worse. I was afraid this would happen. And we don't know how it's going to end. This country has burned twice. Burned in the Civil War. And it was burning during the Great Depression. And I think it was thanks to Franklin Roosevelt's leadership that the country did not literally burn, because it could have. And so do we have to burn again? That was my thesis going into 2016. I mean, just looking at history and the forces that were at play and the notion of equality and how far out of whack things have gotten, would it take a burning? Would it take something like a revolution to get us back on track to being a plausibly genuine constitutional democracy? And I think in the 4 years since 2016, you know, we become a lot less equal. I think our government is even more dysfunctional, and the stakes are even higher. So I think, and that's one reason I chose not to go out in 2020. I felt like I pretty much said everything I had to say for a while. In Beautiful Country Burn Again, and it's still playing out. And so I decided I would stay home and have fun and write a novel.
And I'm burdening you by bringing these things up again.
No, not at all. I think about them all the time.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to talk a little bit more about those two times in the past when we've burned as a country or got close to burning, the times when we had to reinvent ourselves as a country, which is what you write about. Now, one, the Civil War, you said, that's race. One, the Great Depression and the New Deal that came from it was concerns about capitalism run amok, right? One's economic, one's racial. What's this one now? Is it a combination of the two?
Well, the Civil War, I mean, that was economic as well.
True.
Slavery came about. Race-based slavery was invented to serve a particular kind of economic system.
So you can't tease those apart, can you? Race
no.
And the, yeah.
No, no. It's all bound up together. It was a war, a battle to enlarge the notion of equality that's in the founding words, the Declaration of Independence. You know, all men created equal, all endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, among these the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Well, when you're in a state of bondage, that is the very antithesis of having the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You are someone's property. And the way it worked in the American South was, your enslaver pretty much had power of life and death over you in virtually all circumstances. And that's about as far away as you can get from the notion of equality as we can imagine. And so you can look at the Civil War as you know, an attempt to get farther, you know, to take a profound step towards, you know, really fulfilling this notion of equality. By the time we get to the Great Depression, it's economic tyranny. And I look at the founders of the country, they were dealing with the problem of political concentrations of power. And they were very concerned with preventing these concentrations. They didn't want a king. And so that's where we get the separation of powers, you know, legislative, judicial, executive. That's where we get the state and federal levels. I mean, these are, you know, breaking up concentrations of power. But what they couldn't foresee were the tremendous concentrations of economic power that came about with the Industrial Revolution. And so by the time of, you know, the early 1930s, you know, those powers and the tremendous concentrations of wealth and political power that go with it had really put, you know, a critical mass of Americans in a state of peonage, you know, subsistence living, with no real shot at pursuit of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And so, I mean, there was a need for a new kind of revolution, another revolution, an expansion of this notion of equality.
That Roosevelt said, necessitous men are not free men. People who are hungry, this is quoting from you quoting him in the book, people who are hungry and out of a job are the stuff of which dictatorships are made. Talk about what he meant.
I just gave a really long explanation and felt like I was losing some of y'all, so I'm going to try to go shorter this time. But it's a really profound statement, and to the extent I fall short in my explanation, you know, if you're interested, do take a look at that chapter in Beautiful Country, Burn Again. It's called Two American Dreams. But, I mean, when Roosevelt said those words, I mean, we were still in the depths of the Depression, still before 1935. What he was recognizing was, if people are living at subsistence level, they really have no meaningful degree of autonomy, self-determination. I mean, when you're living at subsistence level, it's you are spending all your energy, all your effort just to get through the day, just to get enough to get your body to the next day. And so it is extremely difficult to be the citizen, a functioning citizen of a functioning democracy when you're living that way, in addition to all the psychological and physical stress you're under. And I think Roosevelt was specifically looking at Germany in that same era and the failure of the Weimar Republic and the way that laid the groundwork for someone like Hitler, a strong man, to come in and take power because people were so desperate. They were at the end of their ropes. And here's somebody who's offering, you know, hope. If you trust me, then I will make everything okay. I mean, obviously, that's not a democracy. That's something much different. It's a terrible explanation, but...
Oh, it's there was a... seemed like such an apt description or comparison in some ways, or at least I was fascinated by a section in the book where you compare Donald Trump to J.R. Ewing. I'm glad you know who that is. You guys remember Dallas, of course, right? At least the older ones. So you write out in your book, Bobby was supposed to be, he was supposed to be the star. He was supposed to be the guy. But for some reason, the audience really responded to JR. This is what you write. JR was a snake and a bastard, and he cheated on his wife, and he made the show his own. And this was the part that got me. You talk about how he lied and cheated and swindled, but no more than the system itself. And he was authentic in the sense that he hardly tried to hide it. His honesty in lying. That's my twist on your sentence. His honesty was thrilling. Talk a little bit about that comparison.
Well, I mean, Dallas was a terrible show. And, you know, it was melodramatic. It was clunky. It was thudding. But there was something like going on with that. And that something was JR. And I think what people were responding to was, you know, every week we would tune in, and he felt genuine. I mean, yeah, he was lying and cheating and swindling and like shredding the ideals of younger people but it felt real. It felt genuine. And so I think that's what people were responding to. It was, he's rigging the system. But the system's rigged already. This feels real. This feels right. And Larry Hagman, I mean, he's a very smart guy. He took it and ran with it. He discovered the pagan id at the heart of good Christian America. And you notice you never saw the Ewings in church.
Right?
And this is in Dallas, Texas. Anyway.
Here's one of the questions you ask about that. Why would we care about someone who, as you put it, truly did not give a shit about anyone else? Which gets to the question I think a lot of people are wondering, and that is, what was the appeal? The idea that it's rigged, and somebody was saying it, someone was, because he, you know, speaks his mind, he's not politically correct, all of those kinds of things. I mean, does that get at the essence of the appeal of someone like Donald Trump?
I mean, he felt authentic. There was something going on with JR that spoke to the way the world is. And we could live vicariously through JR. Those of us who hopefully aspire to greater scruples and smaller deficits of integrity, you know, but we could live vicariously through JR. And I mean, you know, it was a terrible TV show, but there was this thing going on, and it captivated the country, you know, for 5 or 6 or 7 years.
That's Ben Fountain. He's the author of Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, and most recently, Beautiful Country, Burn Again. We spoke in front of a live audience at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts. Fountain was a guest of the Tanner Humanities Center. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
What's it like being the rabbi at the largest synagogue in Salt Lake City?
They said, no, who's like above you religiously? And so I was like, God? And they went, oh. And they went home and told their parents, our next door neighbor is the Jewish prophet.
Rabbi Samuel Spector from Congregation Kol Ami, and much more this week on Preach. It's a special episode recorded at our very first live show. Find it wherever you get your podcasts or at preachpod.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're broadcasting our conversation with the novelist and essayist Ben Fountain. He has an interesting story. He was a successful real estate lawyer, but then quit everything at 30 to write. His first novel and story collection were bestsellers. His latest is about the American presidential election in 2016. Fountain joined us recently on stage at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts.
There's this historical a part of the book where you talk about certain phonies who burst onto the scene, had their time, and then were sort of tossed aside That's an interesting part. Like, what is the lifespan of a phony? We'll talk about that in a minute. But I wanted to ask about a few of these. One, some may be familiar with Pappy McDaniel, but would you talk a little bit about Pappy O'Daniel, mm-hmm. Who had this raw emotional appeal from Texas? So people in your part of the country may remember and know who he is, but others may as well. He's a fascinating character. Just talk a little bit about him as an historical figure, because he's an interesting part of this, I think.
Well, this was the first piece I wrote for The Guardian that was published in The Guardian, and it came out in late January, early February. And I was looking at the campaign before us, and I was looking at all these characters, and I was looking at all the loose talk, hearing all the loose talk and verbiage going on. And there was a part of me that felt like, oh, God, here we go again. I mean, it's the fundamental task of citizens in a democracy to try to discern what is real and what is fake, to figure out who's feeding you a line of bull and who's the genuine article. It's hard. It gets harder every day. And so I thought, you know, let's think about this, you know, in terms of con men. You know, because I felt like there was a lot of conning going on out there. And so I started looking into a couple of historical figures, you know, who personified the political con man. And Pappy O'Daniel was one of those. I mean, he was a flower salesman in Fort Worth. He got a 15-minute radio show, which became a sensation. And he was really the first big media celebrity of the Southwest. And he parlayed that into a really stunning political career. He won 4 statewide elections in 6 years in Texas and ended up in the U.S. Senate. And, you know, just a charlatan of the first order. And I don't mention Trump. I think I only mentioned Trump once, and that's in the lead-in to the piece where I'm lumping him in with all the other candidates. But obviously that's who I'm thinking of the most. I mean, a media celebrity who leverages his expertise with this particular medium into something far beyond mere money-making.
What did you learn about whether Pappy it was interesting because you write about how O'Daniel was clearly performing, it seems, right? So, like, he was different from his private persona was really different from this public one. He was aloof and awkward in private. But then as soon as the microphone was on, he lit up. And you asked this question about whether or not he believed his own shtick and was self-aware enough about whether this was conscious manipulation or it was an act. And I want to ask what you think about Pappy O'Daniel, but also if you can extend that to whether or not you think Donald Trump, to the degree that he has shtick, believes his shtick.
I mean, we're getting into really interesting psychological territory here. I mean, how much exactly do these people believe, you know, when they're saying it? And one person who knew Pappy O'Daniel pretty well said he believes it when he's saying it.
Right.
But I mean, it really was a facade because he was a skinflint. He paid people really poorly, treated them poorly. He presented himself as a populist, you know, for the common people. He was bankrolled by a bunch of oil millionaires in Dallas. He did absolutely nothing for the common people when he was governor of Texas and senator. I mean, he took care of the moneyed interest. But what exactly is going on when somebody is saying, you know, giving you one kind of rhetoric, but their actions are so drastically opposed to what they're saying? And, You know, I think it's a shifting, I think it's a sliding scale. Hmm. I think from one person to another, it differs. And with the same person, sometimes they believe it more, sometimes less. You look at a figure like Rush Limbaugh. He says, I'm a performer. You know, it's, but when he gets on the radio, it's like, wow, he sure sounds like he means it. And he says it, he's been doing it year after year after year after year. That's a hell of a performance. And a figure like, what's his name in Austin, Texas? The InfoWars guy.
Oh, yeah, Alex Jones.
Yeah, during his divorce proceedings, you know, his estranged spouse is saying, you know, he's a horrible person. You know, just listen to what he says on the radio. And he says, that's just a performance. Well, his manager is over there saying, no, it's real. It's genuine. You know, we're going to lose our fan base. No, it's real. So it's fraught territory.
There's another phony of another era. Similar era, I guess, Joseph McCarthy, you write about. It's a great section in the book. But you also, in that section, quote Edward R. Murrow, who sort of began the pushback for McCarthy with this televised commentary about him. And he said this, which you quote in the book, Murrow, "We will not be driven by fear into an age of unreason." And I wonder, was he right?
Well, we certainly were for a while. And there's something in the American character that is especially vulnerable to appeals to fear. And Joseph McCarthy, he played that tune to perfection for about 4 or 5 years. And, a total phony. On the warpath for communists, he never found a communist. Out of all the investigations he did, there was not a single indictment, not a single conviction. It was all smoke and mirrors and PR and puff. And the irony is, the U.S. government was riddled with Soviet spies at that time, but he didn't catch any.
There's an American scholar who wrote about grifters and con artists that you quote. David Maurer is his name. And he said, another quote from him that you use in your book, "It's not intelligence but integrity which determines whether or not a man is a good mark." Because as you say, the con can't work without a willing mark.
Yeah, a con won't work on an honest person because a con always requires, you know, buy-in by the mark. You know, you're trying to get them involved in something that is not above board, that's dishonest on some level. So the mark has to want what you're offering. And so when we look at these con men and women through American history, I mean, it's easy in retrospect to condemn them. Pappy O'Daniel, he was a charlatan of the First Order, and so is Joseph McCarthy. Joseph McCarthy ruined a lot of lives. He drove one young public servant to suicide. And so it's easy in retrospect for most of us to say these are terrible people. But what is it in our national character, in our collective psyche, that is vulnerable to appeals like this? On some level, do we want what they're offering? Do we want the racist, xenophobic, you know, fear-baiting, paranoid, line that generation after generation of politicians succeed by offering to us?
You write in the book about this, as you put it, this human talent for distraction has always been with us. And then you give it a name. You spend some time with it, the fantasy industrial complex, which is relentless, you say, it's infinite, and it's an art, is how you describe it. Explain the FIC, the fantasy industrial complex.
The FIC. All right, the fantasy industrial complex. I was, writers are desperate people. And so I was invited to the U.S. Air Force Academy to give a lecture to all the cadets and faculty. And this was after Billy Lynn came out. And so here I am, I'm to the left of Gandhi, and I'm going out to one of the military academies to give a speech, and I'm not going to pull punches. I mean, it's like they invited me, so here I come. And I felt like certainly by that point in our history, it had become evident painfully evident that the Iraq War had been sold to us on false pretenses. I mean, that is part of the historical record. It was certainly part of the historical record by 2013. How were we bamboozled? How did we allow ourselves to be so misled? How did our leaders, how were they so successful in misleading us? And so I was looking at the lead up to the war, and then, you know, once the war started, and there was a very concerted, public relations doesn't do it justice. There was a very concerted, culture-wide, you know, effort to sell this war. And everything was brought to bear. All the arts, all the dark arts of advertising and behavioral psychology. And I'm like, what is this thing? And it was so powerful, it took over the military-industrial complex. And basically, the fantasy-industrial complex made the military-industrial complex its bitch. And I mean, we all go around thinking, oh, the military-industrial complex is, you know, the most powerful and insidious force in American society. No. No, it's all this other stuff that's coming at us, you know, at an increasingly frenetic rate through all the screens of our lives, you know, through, you know, just, you know, cell phones, computers, televisions. And then, you know, you got the radio. I mean, it's just, and it amps up, you know, geometrically every year. So that's me trying to put a name to this infinitely expanding blob, you know, in our culture.
Where we are right, like right now, New Hampshire, stakes for the Democrats. Where are we now in terms of economic uncertainty? And you write in Beautiful Country, Burn Again, that Bernie Sanders, for example, represented, this is how you describe it, what may be the biggest gamble in American politics since the New Deal. He has ideas about universal health care and tuition-free college and living wages for everybody. So how are you thinking about that today in the conversation that's going on within the Democratic Party about the fact that it's too big a gamble with the stakes of Donald Trump being on the other end of that? So pragmatism versus principle. Choose the moderate candidate, because that's the candidate that's going to appeal to those in those middle Rust Belt states that are so crucial in the electoral college, you know, equation, all of that. How are you thinking about, and how should we be thinking about all of that, do you think?
I walk around in a constant state of confusion, bewilderment, fear, occasional hope. In other words, I'm like everybody else. And I'm trying to make sense of you know, this thing that's out there. A couple of things. The forces and structures in society that led to the profound economic meltdown of 2008 are still in operation. Nothing fundamentally has changed. And people whose judgment I trust even say it's probably worse. And so, number one, there's that. So we're still very vulnerable. And probably it's only a matter of time before we are faced with another existential economic crisis, number one. Number two, inequality of power, economic inequality of opportunity have become so drastic and profound in this country that maybe nothing less than a kind of political revolution has any chance of getting us back on track to being an arguably genuine constitutional democracy. I mean, when you look at the role of big money in politics, I mean, the rise of PACs and super PACs, and then the Citizens United decision. And, I mean, just the oceans of dark money, I call it black money, that flows into elections now. You wonder, is the system capable at this point of correcting itself, of curing itself? Is this what Bernie Sanders is talking about when he says, we need a political revolution? I mean, I think he's absolutely sincere when he says that, and this is a man taking his political logic to its ultimate conclusion. For anything to change, everything is going to have to change. That is scary. And when you look at, I mean, I personally get the heebie-jeebies. I also think he's right, but that's beside the point. I mean, no, really. I mean, we aren't here to talk about Ben Fountain's politics, but, you know, I'm trying to impart to you the ways I'm trying to make sense of things, you know, in good faith, all the good faith I can muster, bringing to bear all the things I've read, life experience, you know, teachers, everything. It's like I need all these to try to make sense of our situation. And so when you look at the numbers, again, economics being the ultimate reality, and you look at the real revolution that Bernie Sanders is proposing, I mean, a wholesale restructuring of American society. Will it lead us to the promised land, or is it going to lead us off a cliff? One thing about Franklin Roosevelt was, I mean, we were facing an abyss. And he would go on the radio and he would say, this is what we're going to try. I will tell you frankly, I don't know if it will work. If it doesn't work, we'll try something else. And I'll stop there.
You said your own politics have become, since writing the book, more radical as a result of doing this. How are you thinking about... I actually wanted to ask you this. What did you think about Mitt Romney?
I felt like it was the least he could do.
You say in the book that we are, as you put it, fast approaching the point where the fantasy can no longer be sustained. And you say that with people like Pappy, with people like McCarthy and others, eventually the magic wears off and something breaks. And then there's a turn. 5 or 6 years, you say, is kind of the shelf life. It runs its course. What are you seeing in the Donald Trump project that makes, where does it seem to be? Will it? Can it? I mean, are you seeing anything? Are you seeing any kind of momentum that's making you think, oh, it's following the same kind of pattern, or this pattern might be different?
Yeah. I mean, just looking at it in a fairly non-systematic way, it seems like demagogues, their run tends to last 5 or 6 years. And there are exceptions to that. But and so when you think Trump came down the escalator in June of 2015, and so 5 or 6 years puts us past 2020. And he looks very strong. he looks very strong. I don't see... I mean, I don't see any cracks in that act right now. I was talking about two things when I said reality is stronger than all of us. I mean, you can keep a fantasy going, but sooner or later, reality is stronger than any of us. And, I mean, on a personal level, if we're living on credit cards and living beyond our means, and, you know, sooner or later, the reckoning comes. If we're abusing our bodies, you know, sooner or later the reckoning comes. On a societal level, if we aren't taking care of our economic house, if the structures we have in society are not taking care of the broad mass of people, but only a few, sooner or later, the reckoning will come. I mean, it's just, you know, I thought 2008 was going to be it. And, you know, the economic reckoning. And we came very close. All of those things are still in play that led us to that point. Nothing has been, you know, cured or remedied in a fundamental way. As far as a figure, you know, any political charlatan, and you know, we happen to be talking about Trump right now, sooner or later reality catches up. And I mean, with George W. Bush, it was Katrina. And we don't know what it will be, what form the reckoning will take with Trump, but it's almost a law of nature that it will happen. And I think when it does happen, the country will turn on him pretty quickly in an extremely vicious and violent way. He will be despised. But it's going to flip. It won't be a gradual thing. It will be one big thing after a number of things, or an accumulation of lots of small things, and then just one small thing. I could be totally wrong. I mean, and so you can seek me out, you know, in 3 years and say, you don't know anything. And I would say, guilty as charged. I mean, but that's just my sense, just based on 61 years of life experience, that sooner or later, the reckoning will come.
Are you one of those writers who doesn't like to talk about the novel they're writing?
Oh, I'll talk some. It's a novel set in Haiti in the aftermath of the 1991 coup that took out Jean-Bertrand Aristide. He had been elected president, had been in office 7 months, and was taken out in a coup d'etat by the Haitian military, very much under the sponsorship of the CIA and the American National Security apparatus. And so I'm following, you know, the aftermath of that coup, which leads to the embargo of Haiti and some very desperate years there.
So it's fiction based on historical reality. It must be nice to write about characters you can just create yourself, right?
Oh, facts are such, you know, facts are just, they are a real pain in the rear. And so writing Beautiful Country Burn Again, I decided, I mean, there's a lot of loose talk in our political culture. It's not a newsflash, right? I mean, and even reputable sources, when you dig into it, you can see they're trimming, they're cutting corners. And I thought, no, I want to hold myself to, like, I'm just going to hold myself to a masochistic standard. And so I insisted on footnotes in the book, not endnotes. I want you, if you're reading a passage and you think, oh, Ben Fountain, you know, what's he talking about here? Your eye can drop down to the footnote down there, and if you choose, you can follow the reference there, or you can, you know, you can see where I'm getting this, and sometimes it's more than just a sight. You know, there will be an elaboration, but I mean, I felt like I wasn't going to do anybody good, including myself, if I wasn't as scrupulously honest as I could be, and I'm sure I fell short. But with fiction, I mean, fiction has its own, requires its own kind of absolute honesty and fidelity, but it's in a different realm.
Ben Fountain, thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much, Ben.
That's Ben Fountain. His latest book is Beautiful Country, Burn Again. He joined us recently on stage at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts. Our thanks to the Tanner Humanities Center for sponsoring the event. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter @Radio West. Our intern is Nacho Tue, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard, Ali Vallarta, and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.